these people who run the world understand sheeple better than you would ever believe. And you'd better quit being sheeple right this moment. You'd better pull the wool out from over your eyes. Take off that fur coat. Stand up on your own two feet. Stop buying. Get ready to fight for your freedoms or lose them all very shortly.
Hello and welcome to Dialect during BCFM's emergency schedule, incorporating the BCFM politics show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We're not live, and the Bristol FM version of the show may be screened by BCFM editorial staff, so a few changes around here. Unprecedented times. The COVID-19 lockdown has seen democracy suspended, local elections and parliament. Normal behaviour such as travel and freedom of association is being criminalised. Potentially, that's up to the police. The questions, are these extreme measures justified and how long will they last? In his press release on the lockdown this week, Avon and Somerset Chief Constable Andy Marsh says the measures are indefinite. Still, the show must go on, and with contradictory reports about the origin of the virus and about what we can and can't do, we'll do our best to stay on the air every week. So we'll be looking at how to recognise and treat COVID-19, but also questioning the government's withdrawal of civil liberties. Also asking the big questions the mass media seem afraid to about the virus's origin, naturally occurring or man-made. Is COVID-19 in fact a bioweapon? Also, renewed activity at RAF Fairford in Gloucestershire. What have plane spotters been seeing there over the last few weeks and why should we be concerned? We look at the media coverage as the BBC World Service's independent current affairs daily show, World Update, is suspended indefinitely, as well as the Victoria Derbyshire show on television and others, just when we need essential journalistic workers most. And finally, here in New Zealand, as the trial of the March 2019 mosque shooter who killed 51 worshippers in a Christchurch mosque begins, and he pleads guilty, we ask, why is the trial and Royal Commission being held in secret? And who were the three figures in red who appear at crucial points in the shooter's live streamed video? Why is the Black Sun in his manifesto also strictly banned in New Zealand? Also, Event 201 and ID 2020. Why does Bill Gates' name keep popping up in the coronavirus scandal? So we start this week with an interview with David Halpin. He's a retired orthopaedic surgeon, and I spoke to him earlier about what he makes of the coronavirus panic.
I'm David Halpin. I'm a retired orthopaedic and trauma surgeon, but I always say that I'm a doctor first and a surgeon second. I was trained at St. Mary's in Paddington, the home of penicillin, and I was trained, I think, pretty well, which included bacteriology and immunology.
I'd like to ask you, first of all, what you make of the measures that the government has brought in to limit the spread of this coronavirus.
The information coming from government and the orders are over the top, and they have created mass hysteria, as intended.
When you say they're over the top, how would you be stopping the spread of something like this?
Well, the thing is that I just had two papers come in today, one yesterday and one just now, and it's come in from Marseille, from a laboratory which deals with about 4,000 hospital beds. And I will quote them. The problem of SARS-CoV-2 is probably overestimated, as 2.6 million people die of respiratory infections each year, compared with less than 4,000 deaths for SARS-CoV-2 at the time of writing. And the time of writing was the 2nd of March. Things have changed since then. But another group, public health doctors from the four nations of Great Britain, have not classified it most recently as a serious disease. So this is counter to what the government and and Professor Chris Whitty have been saying. It has been exaggerated.
One of the reasons that it's being suggested that maybe the government has downgraded the severity, I mean, it's not the government, sorry, England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland have downgraded it, is because legally they have to do that because they don't have the protective equipment, the protective gear, these sort of hazmat suits, enough of them to go around, and they're legally supposed to do that. So they've downgraded it to get themselves out of that one.
I'm not sure about that. There's exaggeration, too, about the need for the PPE, as they call it, the protective equipment. When they're dealing with equally lethal, in fact, probably more lethal strains of influenza virus in the winter, you don't find them using hazmat suits. The hazmat suits were often shown on television, on BBC particularly. I only have watched BBC. That's been shown, I think, to add to the fright of people.
How unprecedented is the COVID-19 illness?
Its effects are known well in other types of influenza virus and cold virus. Apparently they have muscle pain, have a high fever, and they have a cough. And those are common symptoms of influenza. There are some particular things. The difference between the effect on younger, fit people, which is often minor or hardly noticed, and yet it can be lethal in the frail elderly, particularly, or those with medical conditions. That is a bit unusual, I would say. But what is not said is how sickly the British population is, and how possibly sickly is the Italian population. I don't know the facts about that, but there are not enough facts, and they should include autopsies and studies on the viruses within the corpses. And you don't hear much about that, but nothing about it.
So how sure can we be that the figures that we're getting are actually deaths from COVID-19?
One thing, Tony, is that the viruses, several viruses can coexist in the same body. That's one thing I've learned. No one can imagine that. These viruses can cause a pneumonia by themselves. They're, after all, being inspired as droplets, we imagine, and they settle in the lungs, and that can cause a pneumonia. I think that probably accounts for some of the elderly deaths. But they can also then happen to have a bacterial pneumonia secondary to the viral infection. And that's how a lot of people are carried off. I recall, as a medical student and young doctor, being told that pneumonia was the old man's friend. That's food for thought, isn't it? What that is indicating is that some people, as they become very aged and they fail, some of them, in fact, are failing badly, go on to nursing homes and care homes in this country, and you'll see them with their heads lolling on their chests while the television is on in the corner. These people are near to death in life.
When it comes to signing a death certificate and putting the cause of death, I mean, it seems to me that there could be multiple causes of death. What does a doctor do in those sort of circumstances?
You would be disgusted to know that of all hospital deaths currently, only about 1-2% go to autopsy. It's been shoveled aside, probably on grounds of cost involving pathologists. But I know, as a conscientious surgeon and doctor, that you need to examine the patients if they die, and then you learn more about how good or how poor you were in your diagnosis. And that is absolutely crucial in any decent medical service.
We've had unprecedented restrictions on people's freedom of association and freedom of movement. To what extent do you think those justified from a medical point of view?
Well, it is contradictory. The fact is that people were flying in from China, where they knew they had this novel virus, so-called novel virus. There was no attempt to stop them being flown into Heathrow or elsewhere, and it was the same in America. And I wrote to an online medical journal about that very early on, saying that they'd shut the stable door when the horse had bolted. And it was the same with Ebola when that Scottish nurse came back, Kafiki. She was allowed to come back from Sierra Leone. She was ill by the time she got to Heathrow, wasn't picked up there, is that it was negligent that she was not quarantined in Sierra Leone for the three-week incubation period for that disease, away from the sick patients, and then allowed to come home. This is an example of the shambolic nature of public health control in this country.
The trouble is, David, people will say, well, it just took them a while to get round to actually realising how serious this was.
It depends.
Just as it happened in China.
They have dismantled the public health system pretty well in this country. And a lady who I have contact with, Professor Alison Pollock, who is at Newcastle, has said this very clearly about a week ago. She speaks out of the health service as well. She's quite well known. And she said, there's no question, the public health system has been dismantled. In Devon, Devon County Council are responsible for the public health officer. And that doesn't bode well, given the average caliber of county councillors. We had a good system, and it was working better in Soho in 1858, when Dr. Snow and the councillors took the pump handle away in an epidemic of cholera, which was affecting the whole of London.
What about the symptoms, David? What are the symptoms? How do we know if we've got this? And you know,
well,
what...
apparently, some people hardly know that they're ill at all. They're virtually symptomless, and yet still Professor Whitty is calling it a disease. He says some of them are symptomless. Well, they don't call it a disease. But people get a fever. They have a dry cough.
That's basically a high temperature.
But some of them are going to work. They don't feel ill enough to stop working. But they have a fever, and they have a dry, persistent cough. But there are bugs been going around for the last few winters where people have had a cough for weeks on end. Probably another virus, I don't know.
What about treatment? If you were landed with your hazmat suit with a COVID-19 patient, what do you think would be a basic, you know, your basic treatment?
Well, the thing, you have to make sure that the lungs are working, and they're able to measure the oxygen concentration in the peripheral blood with these simple instruments. And you know that a minority of people are admitted to intensive care wards, usually the elderly with other medical conditions, which we keep hearing about. They talk about other medical issues is the usual term, but you never hear what those conditions are. Now, there is an epidemic of obesity in Britain, and in fact in other countries, particularly America. But obesity has a big effect on lung capacity, on your breathing capacity. The diaphragm is pushed upwards by gross obesity. And that might be one factor, among others, which causes more people to be sicker than they otherwise would be. And other things like heart failure. This country has a lot of sickly people in it. And you have to walk around your local town on a Saturday to see it. And people are very poorly informed about how they should maintain their health. Some people have given up. Some people are depressed and they don't care for themselves. And that's very obvious, in fact, if you observe as a doctor.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, what I'd like to say, actually, Tony, is that they've generated an apocalyptic atmosphere and there's a purpose in it. I don't like it. I'm concerned that there is a large fleet in the Persian Gulf, mostly American. They've now got so-called nuclear weapons on the intercontinental ballistic missiles, in the submarines as well. And cruising the Atlantic, they can still attack Iran from that. And don't forget that Netanyahu and his fellow psychopaths have been urging America to destroy Iran for the last 10 years at least. And they're waiting for a pretext. I wrote about it on the 14th of June last year in Global Research. I think I outlined it fairly well. They're waiting for a pretext, and I suspect that this is a vast distraction.
Well, you can say suspect, but do you have any evidence for that?
Right. The thing is that there is evidence of an American general in the Department of Defense who is obviously quite warm about first-strike nuclear capability. And we're dealing with a very unstable world with leaders, so-called leaders, who have massive weaponry. And the fuse is short. I'm absolutely certain that a war is in the offing.
That was Dr. David Halpin speaking to me earlier from Devon, and he was one of the doctors who questioned the alleged suicide of Dr. David Kelly back in 2003 at the time of the illegal invasion of Iraq. And that was The Specials with Ghost Town. Our next interview this week is from Oxford CND. He's talking about the situation over in Fairford. Fairford is an airfield, which is an RAF airfield, but it's actually run by the United States Air Force. And plane spotters, bless them, have been noticing quite a lot of interesting new activity there recently.
I'm Nigel Day. I'm a coordinator of Oxford Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, CND, and our concern about our local airfield, which is RAF Fairford, we tend to call it USAF Fairford. It's an American base under signage that says RAF Fairford, but in fact is a wholly American base. Now, the importance of that base is that it's a very large runway, and it is the European base for the American B-2 stealth bomber, which is the strategic nuclear-capable bomber that would lead any kind of assault. So that's a very important base. It has all the gear for that. It's the only one in Europe that can take that particular plane, and it's the base where Other bombers such as the B-52s and the B-1s have attacked Iraq in the past, so it's a very important base sitting on the Oxfordshire-Wiltshire-Gloucestershire border. Aircraft based there at the moment seem to be U-2 spy planes. So these spy planes come in and land at Fairford, stationed there for a short time, and off they go. So it has recently been mobilized up to a higher degree of importance, and so the U-2s are operating from there. But intermittently and occasionally, you will have an exercise where bombers come in. So you've got B-52 bombers, which are old bombers but nuclear capable, and you have B-1 bombers as well. At the latest plane in that kind of category is the B-2 stealth bomber, very important plane, and that will come occasionally and be stationed at Fairford.
What's the history of the base?
It goes back a long way. It was an RAF base and then kind of declined a bit. And then you'll remember in the end of the 70s, there was a question of they were going to bring cruise missiles to Britain. And they also needed a place where they could have fuel planes that would fuel bombers. And so people of Newbury didn't want the refueling planes to be stationed there. So they were stationed at Fairford to revive the base, and the cruise missiles went into Greenham Common. And so that's the history of it. It's had that kind of backup to many, many kind of things. So a refueling base and then developed into a bomber base.
Didn't the Pentagon say they would close it down a few years ago?
There was a suggestion of that, but they didn't actually say they were going to close it. What they said they would do, they would go on to a kind of care and maintenance basis. But in actual fact, it meant there were just a few Americans that stationed there to keep the base online. But they actually spent a huge amount of money on the runway, upgrading the facilities. And so we're now entering it's kind of reversed all of that in the fact that it's a much more operational base now.
Going back to the history, what was its role in past conflicts?
In the first Gulf War, B-52 bombers were stationed there, and then later in the Second Gulf War, they were stationed there again. So they attacked Iraq from Fairford. American B-52 bombers were loaded up with bombs, and they attacked Iraq from Fairford. The bombs were supplied from the biggest bomb store in Europe, which is RAF Welford, which is near Hungerford. So Welford has recently had a whole new storage of bombs, all their old bombs taken away, and they've updated all their bombs, so that place still exists and is full of bombs ready for the next conflict.
Does this make Gloucester a target?
If there was a nuclear war, then Fairford obviously would be a target.
And what do you know about the nuclear convoys?
I am quite a lot. I've been involved with nuclear convoys for a long, long time. The nuclear UK nuclear factory is near Reading at Atomic Weapons Establishment Burfield. All the bits for the bombs are made at Atomic Weapons Establishment Aldermaston. They're then taken 7 miles away to Burfield, where they assemble and disassemble nuclear weapons. So every now and again, a convoy is loaded up with, I don't know how many warheads, some warheads, Trident warheads, and they're then transported by road in a convoy, heavily armed, all the way to the Royal Naval Armaments Depot at Coalport, and that is right next to the submarine base at South Lane in Scotland. So that's where the weapons are stored. They're not stored in England. When they assemble a warhead, taken up in a convoy and stored at Coalport. When the submarines need a new warhead on their missiles, they're taken round from Fast Lane to Coalport, and that's where the new missiles and the warheads and everything is loaded up. To carry these weapons, they have to go from Berkshire, Scotland, and then some are brought back from Scotland for maintenance, for checking, and because they are depleted. So that's my interest. I want to monitor these particular convoys, which I regard as the most dangerous cargo in the UK, because they are passing our cities, our schools, our hospitals, and most people are not aware. They just see a convoy that looks like an army convoy and don't take any notice.
NATO?
Yes.
What do you think our future role will be in NATO now that we've chosen the route of Brexit?
Well, it has nothing to do with Brexit, in a way. That's irrelevant to our role in NATO. In fact, our role in NATO is far more important, probably as a treaty, than our European treaties were ever. Most important, we want to found the members of NATO, but it does mean that our nuclear armament is assigned to NATO. So we have no control, really, of where this is going. The targeting is all sorted by NATO, and so we are under the wing of NATO. So we have to do what they've been told. And the problem with NATO is started off as a North Atlantic Treaty Organization. That's what it means. It's now fighting in Afghanistan. It's all over the Middle East. And one country in South America has now asked to be part of NATO. So it's expanding all the time, totally different to how the thing was established. The other effect is more closer to us, because at the time, at the end of the Cold War, President Gorbachev and President Reagan got things together and talked, and one of the agreements made was that NATO would not expand into Eastern Europe, into the former Soviet territories. And that's exactly what has happened now. It's gone into the Ukraine, right into the Baltic states, right up to the border of Russia. And we are installing missiles into Poland, Romania, etc. And you can understand this is actually very provocative. But the Russians, you can understand, they're thinking, well, we actually agreed not to do this, and they're right on our borders. We shouldn't be doing this. We should actually be negotiating and talking with people. What Churchill said, he said, George War, not war war. That's what he said. That's what we should be doing. And so when you have stealth bombers based at Fairford, for example, their role is to go very close to the borders. This time, one of the things they did was to operate with the Norwegian Air Force, the F-35s of the Norwegian Air Force. So they're practicing coming working with European forces close to the Russian border. The U-2 spy planes of Fairford go off and are along the Russian border all the time. So occasionally when you hear of a Russian bomber coming towards us, it's well tracked from Norway all the way down. It's actually nothing compared with what we're doing. So I think we have to understand NATO is a warlike machine. We are part of it. We have to pay 2% of our national budget now into NATO. Most of the European countries don't do that, but we do. Britain is paying 2% of our national money into NATO every year, into a warlike machine which we disagree with.
Finally, what other things does CND do these days?
CND has been going for a long time. One of our tasks in CND is to look at the workers. So workers at Barrow, instead of building nuclear submarines, they are very skilled people that could be making, for example, wave-generating electrical things. It's the highest, well, the second highest tidal rise along that west coast in the world. We could be building things and many more jobs out of that, and we would lead the world. Also, the people, the workers, the very skilled workers in Aldermaston and Burfield, these are very skilled people. We could decommission all our nuclear weapons, so they needn't be thrown out in a scrap heap, these workers. We could actually be part of a campaign to reduce all the weapons in the world and do it. For example, South Africa produced a number of nuclear weapons before the end of apartheid. This was secretly done in conjunction with Israel. How it was discovered in the end was they tried to trigger, just the trigger, set the trigger off on Prince Edward Island, which is between South Africa and the Antarctic, but it was spotted by an American satellite, a double flash, which is very indicative of what they were up to. Anyway, after the end of apartheid, Mandela, in secret negotiations, got Aldermaston involved in decommissioning these weapons. I think the Israelis probably stole three of the weapons. The other six were taken to pieces and disappeared by the help from people like Aldermaston. So it can be done. It's possible to decommission nuclear weapons and for us to feel a lot safer.
And that was Oxford CND spokesman Nigel Day talking about various things, including the expansion of operations, particularly of the B-2 stealth bombers from Fairford Airfield in Gloucestershire. Now, I'm joined by Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers to discuss some of the implications of the unprecedented lockdown. Martin, I suppose the first thing to say is these look like almost world war measures without actually a world war taking place.
Well, and they're taking place all over the world simultaneously as well, which is unusual. And when you say the world war isn't taking place, if you look at the war of words between Pompeo and the Chinese leadership over the source of the virus, the hostilities have definitely not been suspended as a result of this threat. And the G7 summit couldn't agree on a statement about the COVID-19 crisis because the US was insisting that it was called the Chinese virus, and the other G7 countries said they weren't going to go along with that. So no statement was made, no final statement was made. And the attack on the Chinese system of government by the current US regime, if we can call it that, seems to be intensifying rather than anything else. There doesn't seem to be any backing off from either side in the war of words about the source of the virus, which, of course, can discuss.
Maybe we could start with that, because there is definitely accusations. I don't think they're stating it as fact, but certainly the Chinese and the Iranians are saying we strongly suspect that the virus was introduced into China at these Military World Games in November 2019, which actually took place in Wuhan. And now, as part of those games, thousands of soldiers from all over the world were doing a kind of little mini Olympics. So what do you make of those accusations?
It's quite clear that the US is hinting that the source of the virus was the biolaboratory in Wuhan, although the mainstream are all still saying that it was, you know, just passed from bats by this market. But the Chinese are responding, will say, as you say, by saying, well, look, we've had a load of your military over here in November. Very interesting stuff, which we mentioned last week on the show, about the Taiwanese virologist saying that the variety of haplotypes of the virus suggests that the source was in the United States. And, of course, there is a very serious question, which is that the U.S. equivalent of Port and Down, Fort Detrick, was closed in July last year. And we need to know why. Why did you close it down?
Well, I can tell you why they closed it down, Martin, and that was because there was checks done on the site, and the government in the United States discovered that it was possible for biological agents to leak from the site, that the procedures there were not good enough, and that's why they closed it down.
You've got to the point about Fort Detrick is we know that that was the source of the anthrax, which killed six people post 9/11. We know that. That's an established...
Okay, the anthrax, the 9/11 anthrax, by the way, was sent to both senators, congress people, and editors of major media in the United States directly after the 9/11 attacks.
Right.
So with looking at the potential origin, you mentioned these haplotypes. Now, there are more haplotypes, which is basically a kind of strain of the virus, in the United States than in China and other places. That does suggest potentially that it was originated there and it's been mutating more in the United States because it's been there longer. But it also suggests that maybe the virus has come back to the US and mutated since it's come back for some reason more in the US than elsewhere.
Well, that may be so. I mean, it's quite possible, let's just be logical here, that it is a virus which has just evolved naturally. And, this crisis has been created by a natural event. But the fact that both sides are suggesting that the other side created a bioweapon, and the fact that the way in which it works, it doesn't kill loads of people, but it creates massive disruption so that the Chinese economy, which has overtaken the size of the US economy in recent years, they've become bigger than the US, and the US doesn't like that. That's been put down, you know, way back. You know, they've been knocked for six. And at the same time as their pig herd died of African swine fever last year, and their flock of chickens has also got bird flu. And it wouldn't be surprising for the Chinese Communist Party to conclude that just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you, especially as Pompeo keeps insisting that the Chinese are responsible for this virus as part of the electoral politics inside the US. That doesn't bode well. And don't forget, the year started with an illegal assassination of a top Iranian general without any consultation with the British by the Americans, whatever. Where, you know, the possibility...
Well, also, Martin,
was quite real.
Let's think about also the detention of the chief financial officer of Huawei, obviously a very important person in Canada, yeah. And the still attempt to extradite her to the United States. And this, of course, is the, many people say, is the trigger for the legislation brought in to try and extradite people from Hong Kong into mainland China, which led to all of the conflict last year. But anyway, let's have a little look at some of the things which really haven't been reported very much, which is the, I'm really shocked to see the lack of reporting on the emergency legislation in the UK about this coronavirus and really to, you know, enforce the lockdown effectively. That one of the concerns about that is that people's regular healthcare has been completely sidelined. I mean, I know personally one elderly chap who has a pre-existing condition who is extremely worried that he's now not getting the treatment that he was getting before. Part of this new legislation is downgrading the disabled care in the new emergency laws. Also, it does look as if these new emergency laws, so-called emergency laws, are going to be in place for 2 years. Now, there were calls for a sunset clause after 6 months, after 9 months, but that, apparently that is not going to happen, that this is going to be in place for 2 years. Now, that seems a really incredibly long time to deal with the disease, especially at a time when the government itself has downgraded the disease. It's no longer considered a high consequence infectious disease. That's in short an HCID. And so it does look as if there's going to be some fairly serious consequences with this new legislation doing all sorts of things like stopping two doctors having to section someone for a limited period of time. I think it used to be 6 months or so. Now one doctor can section anybody, in other words, get them confined to a mental hospital indefinitely. So what do you make of the reporting and the measures that have been brought in, Martin?
Well, I think that the parliamentarians who decided to try and put a sunset clause in this were right. Even if the measures are justified, you don't want to have, I mean, and it may take 2 years for this to play itself out. You still don't have to give legislation for 2 years. You can have it renewed if people are happy with it after 3 months or 6 months. But of course, Parliament itself has now been closed down. So maybe that's the end of that. And of course, that then leads to questions about whether elections are going to take place and so on. I think the dangers of I would argue that people should be able to be told what to do in an emergency like this without being forced. If you tell people what they need to do and explain to them why they need to do it, then they should do it without being coerced, basically. There's no case for coercing people. And, of course, the danger is that this is part of a psychological warfare operation. So let's just what Larry Romanoff has suggested in he's based in Shanghai, but he's an American. He's saying that the it may have leaked out into the US last year. It's been running around in the US for quite a while. They had a panic, decided what they can do. What we can do is we can seed it inside China and Iran, and then we can say they started it, and then there will be all the consequences we're having. Don't forget, we haven't even mentioned the financial and economic consequences, which are devastating. The civil liberties aspects are important, but they're really secondary in many respects. And then, of course, you've got to cover for the collapse of the Western banking system and the imposition of martial law. It's all COVID-19. That's the reason. And, of course, it's not necessarily COVID-19. That's the reason. They wanted martial law anyway, and the COVID-19 gives them the cover. Now, that
One of the other things about the bailouts and this legislation is that there are lots and lots of medium and small businesses that have effectively been forced to close. I mean, over here in New Zealand, where I am stuck on holiday, although, you know, we have a lockdown here too for 3 weeks. But the thing is that the timing may be much longer. Obviously, we realise that.
is that even very large businesses, which are chains across the country, one butchery chain, which is just all it does is sell food, has been told, no, you're going to have to close. Only the large supermarket chains are being able to stay open. And so there are lots and lots of medium and small businesses that effectively have to just grind to a halt.
Yeah, and of course, if you knew that something like this was going to happen, and clearly there's been insider trading by politicians in the US, senators who were briefed for how bad it was going to be, sold all their stock market positions whilst pretending that there was not going to be any major problem. There's actually court cases that are now being initiated in the US about that. But if people say, well, what, the capitalists wouldn't destroy their own system in this way, well, perhaps they would, because don't forget, the collapse of the stock markets was going to happen anyway. The idea that COVID-19 has caused the collapse of all of these derivative trade positions is just wrong. The Federal Reserve was already pumping, extra heroin into the system last year in order to keep the banking system afloat. It was cruising towards the wall. And the COVID-19 situation just provides a perfect cover for the collapse. And, of course, the bailout of Wall Street as well. But what's just been passed by the US Congress is a massive handout to the usual suspects.
Okay, Martin, I mean, this is speculation, and we had the same speculation from David Halpin. But one of the things that's absolute fact is the effect of this is to digitise our social communications. The idea is we're not really supposed to be speaking to each other face to face anymore, but they're happy for us to go on Facebook or wherever, you know, Instagram, Snapchat, and everything has got to go online apart from immediate, you know, communication in your own family, spouses, children, that sort of thing. It's causing an enormous amount of our daily discussions to be digitized and therefore absolutely open to what we know through all sorts of legislation that's been brought in Britain, really, to cover up for criminal activity that was going on before, but surveillance-wise, that this is all being looked at. And this surveillance is increasing. I mean, the particular problem is that there is a whole bunch of data analysts in Britain have written a letter to the government saying, well, we think that the legislation you're bringing in to follow people, which is looking at where exactly everybody is at any one time, it's called contact tracking, is actually breaks all civil liberties. The idea that you're following everybody at all times so that if one person is found to have contracted this virus, that you can then track everybody back to see who they've been near, that this is an extremely important measure to dangerous measure.
At the same time, Tony, we're not carrying out any testing. It's quite clear that the regime in China and South Korea and Singapore, who've managed to get on top of this, have been testing everybody to find out whether they've got the virus or not. We haven't been doing that. So then we have a poor second best is to track the mobile phone tracking of individual people. But if you don't know whether they've got the virus or not anyway, what's the point of that? And that raises questions, doesn't it? And of course, it looks very much like business interests and big pharma are definitely pulling the strings, particularly in the US and Britain, in the response to this crisis. So, and I've just been reading very interesting stuff by Pepe Escobar on Voltaire earlier, but it's also on the Seca, about how Macron has prevented testing in France, and he's basically, that what they're going to push forward is a big form of a compulsory vaccine as the solution to the problem. And, of course, knowing what we know about how the intelligence services work in the West, that the 9/11 attack was an inside job. Donald Trump, on the day of the attack, said those buildings were bombed. They don't just collapse like that. I want to remind all of our listeners of that. That's what he said on the day. And that shows that the 9/11 attack was definitely not carried out by people from caves in Afghanistan. Now, that means that when Pompeo, who's been on the record as saying that he lies, he cheats, he steals, that's what the CIA taught me to do, when he says, believe me, the Chinese started this virus, I believe, basically, I don't believe you. And why should I take you seriously as somebody to tell me what to do in a crisis like this?
Okay, Martin. November 2019, we had calls from the Health Secretary Matt Hancock for a mandatory vaccinations. I mean, this is before this all broke out, at least.
Well,
we haven't even got a vaccine yet.
So why is he saying we're going to have mandatory vaccines when we haven't even got a vaccine? Or maybe they do have a vaccine. Don't forget, 30,000 US soldiers are currently appearing in Eastern Europe
they're saying that's all been scaled right back, Martin. So,
well, nevertheless, you know, they're still coming.
We're not sure how many soldiers
are
coming.
When you're banning people flying across the Atlantic, why are you sending all of these soldiers to either bring infection in or take it back?
It's interesting to note that Robert Horton has flagged this up at Shannon Airport, where many of these troop flights stop and rest there, that no US soldiers are allowed into the terminal building. They all have to stay in the aeroplanes, except in exceptional circumstances. And we're not told what those exceptional circumstances are, though. But look, let's get on to the other. I mean, we've been talking there briefly about November 2019, which seems crucial in uncovering what's really going on with the coronavirus. Because of the World Military Games in Wuhan. But also at that time, Bill Gates was looking at something called Event 201, which was an exercise involving a massive virus breakout around the world. Now, this was only a paper exercise, but it is an interesting coincidence. And now what we're hearing literally in the last few days is that Bill Gates wants to have something called what he's calling ID 2020, which is a digital identity, is talking about an implanted microchip which will tell everybody whether or not you've been vaccinated. And I'm assuming that's for COVID-19. So those people who have been vaccinated can then choose to have this chip so that everybody and all the surveillance systems will know that they have been vaccinated for COVID-19 and that they apparently can't catch it.
If this is a natural virus, we want to use the latest technology, including our data collection technology, to fight it. But of course, there's got to be a suspicion that this is actually a power grab. There's got to be, given what we know about what's gone on in the past, that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, that David Kelly probably was assassinated because he knew too much about things he shouldn't have known about. And that the 9/11 attack, buildings don't collapse like that. You're quite right. They've carried on building skyscrapers ever since. And you'd have thought if they just collapsed like that, there must be a design flaw. So we wouldn't be building them like that. But of course, we are building them like that. And the world knows. And I'll tell you who does know. The Russian general staff, the Chinese general staff, and the Iranian general staff all know very well that the US is run by gangsters. So when they say, we're all on your side, let's all work together to try and stop COVID-19, which is not what they're not saying that. But even if they were saying that, they wouldn't trust them.
Martin, going back to the civil liberties aspects of this, they're also talking about, I mean, obviously talking about surveillance of people, you tracking their mobile phones and that sort of thing. Potentially, I don't know what the situation is in the UK, but here in New Zealand, they're saying they're not going to be putting up roadblocks. Just literally the police spot checking people, like, what are you doing, etc., and asking them questions. But then there's also the question of using drones. That also seems to be now being rolled out, the idea that drones can be used to sort of fly about and look for anybody that happens to be wandering around, so that will then be steering the police in. But one of the things which I find quite frightening about this is the way that the media seems to be being used, certainly here in New Zealand, the stuff we've been listening to, as a kind of enforcer, people being encouraged to dob other people in. So if they see someone going down the street that they think shouldn't be going down the street, or parked in a car park they don't think should be in that car park, or that they suspect that they're making a journey that they shouldn't be making, the idea is to phone the police or phone the media on a live phone in and dob them in.
There are two sides to this, isn't there? People want to do the right thing in terms of fighting this infection, whatever it is. And of course, we've got limited information. We're not quite sure what's involved or how long, you know, and all the rest of it. And then there's the clear incompetence. That's the very minimum that you could say. I mean, Dominic Cummings was moaning this week because it was clear, because we got a leak into the Sunday Times, it was, where he was saying, well, some people are going to die. There'll be old people. We're not going to close the economy down because, you know, that's we don't want to do that. And then, of course, they were forced to backtrack. I mean, Boris himself was saying, we're going to take this on the chin and we're going to squash this sombrero. And then gradually we've turned into this kind of, you know, there's got to have this Orwellian police state to control people's behaviour. Now, what they should have done, as David Halpin pointed out in the interview, is that you should basically control the influx of people in the first place. If you're going to squash a virus like this, you've got to get it on it straight away. Not in general lockdown for the whole population. You've got to identify through testing who is infected and isolate them quickly. And they haven't done that. So this general lockdown is a scattergun approach. And it's also locking the stable door after the horse has bolted. And of course, it's also possibly, we're only speculating here, part of a bigger game, because we may find that at the end of this, we're going to have a simultaneous banking collapse and world war. And the coronavirus bit is just the entree.
Yeah, I mean, a lot can happen. If this legislation is there for 2 years, a tremendous amount can happen. It's almost as if we're already being made aware that we're being told it's just for a few weeks. But in the background, especially with this announcement by Avon and Somerset Chief Constable Andy Marsh, that the measures are indefinite. I mean, he seems to be saying what the media people just simply don't dare to, because that would potentially cause panic if they're saying these measures are indefinite.
Well, this is the thing about taking these kind of measures. They either cause panic, you know. I mean, I think what worked in China is because the culture is relatively, you know, authoritarian. And people are used to being told what to do and getting on.
Well, the people are obedient, basically.
Well, that's right, yes. But I mean, on the other hand, they've also got the individualism of Western culture doesn't help in situations like this sometimes. As you know, the tsunami in Japan was devastating, but the response of the population was exemplary. If something like that happened here or in the United States, you know it wouldn't be. People wouldn't, I mean, and I think all this stuff about the police telling people what to do, I just think that's just not going to work. You can, they can pass legislation in Parliament saying the police have got powers to do this, that and the other. But if people don't voluntarily submit, the police will never be able to control the population doing what they want to do, because they just won't.
I've seen some evidence of pushback from the police saying basically you're asking us to do the impossible.
Well, I mean, they were complaining this week that after these announcements, which they obviously weren't in the loop about, all people are phoning up the police station to ask whether they should go to the park or not. And it's as if the police haven't got enough to do. They've got to field, phone calls from nitwits saying, we're thinking of going to the park, can we go? It's like, well, don't, what are you asking us for? You know, you've been given the information that you've got one trip to the park a day. Why are you phoning us? Well, you know, that you can see what the confusion is here. Yeah, because people want to do the right thing, but they're also suspicious, quite rightly, that they're being asked to do the wrong thing.
Well, one of those main suspicions, Martin, is looking at the effect that flu had 2 winters ago in the UK, where 50,000 extra people died in Britain, across the UK, because of the flu. Now, that means they didn't actually necessarily die of flu, but these were almost all elderly people that had other pre-existing conditions, such as lung disease, heart disease. There's a whole list of them, including diabetes. So there is this question, isn't there, about to what extent this really is such a dangerous virus, when we've had something like 200 deaths in the UK. Obviously, they're trying to flatten the curve. That could increase. But with a massive number of deaths back 2 winters ago, of 50,000 of the flu, is this a reasonable response? And also, we don't necessarily know if the testing regime is not absolutely transparent and has been going since day one. How many people have actually died of this, have died of pre-existing conditions? So there's quite a lot of confusion. But that 50,000 figure just sort of sticks in my mind as, well, I didn't even know that we had 50,000 extra deaths from flu 2 winters ago. What do you make of that as a comparison?
Normal flu, although it's devastating, there's an immunity in the population. Yeah, this is a novel coronavirus. Yes, so nobody's got any immunity. That's the problem. And of course, it can be transmitted even when people haven't got any symptoms, which is unusual. But again, I would come back to the response in China. The Chinese were caught flat-footed at the beginning of the crisis, but they immediately went into this is a bio-warfare attack mode. They had been training for biological attack for years. And that's because the North Koreans were devastated by all sorts of biological agents in the Korean War, and the Agent Orange was sprayed all over Vietnam during the Vietnam War, which killed loads of people and caused all kinds of birth defects and all the rest of it.
Just considering the possibility that it is a biowarfare attack, it is also, if you're looking at the curves of the increase in the cases, it looks as in the next couple of weeks, the United States is going to be the epicenter. In fact, some commentators are saying that the US could have more coronavirus deaths than anywhere else on the planet as a proportion of the population, partly because the government isn't very well organized and they have a sort of minimalistic style government. Also, it's quite authoritarian in some ways, but also because their healthcare system is not able to cope with the situation. Our healthcare system in the UK has also been on its knees, Martin.
Well, all of that is true, but I'd add a further point to that. Of what we were talking at the beginning of this conversation, perhaps it started in the United States. Perhaps it leaked from Fort Detrick. And everything that's happened since, that's what Larry Romanoff is suggesting, if you want to check him out, who's based in Shanghai. He's an American, but he's based in Shanghai. Now, this is all speculation. I think I am very suspicious that this is a psychological warfare attack. That's because I see psychological warfare attacks happening all the time. The attack on Duma with chemical weapons, supposedly.
But it's got this economic aspect, which is absolutely devastating. Oh, yeah. I wonder whether it's, like 9/11 and 2008 all in one bailouts.
Oh, it is, yes. It's a massive bailout for the banks, but they will go down anyway. But the people who walk away, everything that's happened in the last 2 or 3 years is money's been pumped into the hands of the speculators in the US who've used it to buy back shares in their own companies. All of these CEOs have resigned very recently, loads of them. Michael Snyder's got a very good article about this, very suspicious. They've all resigned and taken their pensions and walked away. And of course, you can make a lot of money out of a crashing world stock market if you're an insider and you know when it's going to crash. Just as people will have been knowledgeable about the assassination of Soleimani. Obviously not people like Boris Johnson, who believes in sovereignty, but Americans didn't bother to tell him what they were going to do. But of course, some people will have known what was going to happen, and they will have taken positions which will improve their personal wealth, because they just have to phone their brokers and say, buy Lockheed, buy Raytheon, buy whatever.
And anyway, one of the aspects of this is the media, and the media, as I just said, is being used as a sort of, place to dob in your neighbours and that sort of thing, live on phone-ins. And also we've had a lack of real balance. That is to say, very little scrutiny, press scrutiny of the civil liberties implications of this draconian 2 years coronavirus law, which, it just seems incredible. And also very little satire seems to be around anymore, sending up of our leaders, criticising them for this sort of thing. Very little of that. So I thought we'd have a listen now, particularly since one of my favourite programmes, daily weekday programmes on the BBC World Service called World Update, has been suspended indefinitely. So let's see what, on a recent edition, when it still had an audience of BBC Question Time, the former Tory minister Michael Portillo, and actually BBC personality looking at trains and sort of being nice to everybody on the TV, had to say about whether he valued the BBC or not.
I mean, Howard referred to looking at things over 10 to 15 years, and George has just said everything's going to be the same until 2027. I don't think either one of you has an idea of how quickly this picture is changing, and I'm deeply depressed by both those answers. I think the BBC may be in very serious difficulty if we wait until 2027 before we decide on a different model for how the BBC can be carried forward, not just as a means for us to watch television, but as a means of taking the wonders of the BBC to the world, which at the moment are not available in a modern form. That is to say, they're not available to the individual who wants to buy a BBC programme at the moment that he or she chooses to watch it.
You've got very little time left, but you've had your hand up quite some time, so you may end up having the last word. Right, I just think the BBC is a national institution that we are all proud of, and I don't think anybody should be worrying about paying that licence fee. It's incredibly good value. What I think is the problem is, what are we spending that money on? How much do we pay our presenters? I'm not asking this to you, Fiona, but if we're paying six and seven figure salaries to TV presenters, what does that actually say? Coming back to the lady's first question of tonight, the people that we value in this country, the people that are doing really hard jobs day in, day out for a pittance, why is that money going to pay people to do something here? Well, actually, I think anybody in the audience could get up and present a programme brilliantly as well. Sorry, I'm being
now
controversial.
That is fighting talk.
If you want me to take
me
over,
Michael.
I'll do it for you next week if you like.
Okay, watch this space. Okay.
That's where you get the
well, listen, money. On that bombshell, I won't be sitting here next week. What's your name?
Michael.
Michael will be sitting here next week. Our hour is up just as well.
So that was Michael Portillo on the recent edition of BBC Question Time, when it still had an actual audience. So what do you make of what you've seen of the media coverage of this, Martin, both in terms of the virus itself and its effects and also the emergency legislation?
Well, I think it's extremely worrying. Whether this is justified or not, it would be an extremely worrying situation where the state takes up this kind of power. I'm very aware of the use of psychological warfare techniques by the state and other agencies. We know that the state, the Western intelligence services and their hangers-on do engage in this. There's been another special unit set up to deal with so-called Russian disinformation about coronavirus. We're paying for that through our taxes. Those people will be influencing BBC journalists and so on. So this war of words about where the coronavirus started, the US is trying to suggest that it's the communist system in China that's created the coronavirus. They tried to cover it up, and it came from one of their biowarfare labs. They're not saying that directly, but they're saying it at a second level. But of course, then the Chinese respond by saying, well, our analysis is that you started this. And of course, what's probably going on here, we're just the punters, we're just the guinea pigs, we're just the rats in the maze. People at a higher level than us in the militaries of all the countries concerned know that basically what's going on here is the beginning of a war.
Over the last couple of weeks, what we've seen is, I think you can only describe as an information avalanche, literally every day, new measures, new ways that people have got to change their behaviour. And the media is being used, the broadcast media particularly, as the, you know, you've got to listen daily. Boris has been doing his daily announcements of several days as well, to what is going to be the, you know, the latest new measures in the state of war, and what you have to do and what you mustn't do and what you must do. There's also stories which haven't really been covered because of this, you know, it's what you might call a good month to bury bad news.
Yeah.
One of those is that the Chinese have expelled, probably more than half of the main US journalists from China, including from the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post and the New York Times. All those journalists are being expelled from China, and also vice versa. In the United States, the US has expelled 40% of the Chinese state news agencies' journalists from the United States. So this is actually a massive implications of the Chinese not being allowed to report on what's going on in America, and vice versa, Martin.
Well, that suggests that the whole thing is being turned into a war-fighting situation. I mean, in another universe, we could imagine that all responsible countries will be working together to try and deal with the crisis. But in practice, we already see that the whole thing has been weaponized and turned into an othering game. You know, they started it, we started it, you started it, and all the rest of it.
And the other thing which has been buried is this whole thing about the downgrading of disabled care. Now, you would imagine that if that had happened in a normal times, there would be an absolute furore. In fact, the government would never get away with saying, oh, well, we're not going to be really caring that much for disabled people anymore.
Well, I mean, it is the classic disaster capitalism, isn't it? We're now going to be forced to accept various measures, financial, military, social, which we wouldn't have accepted because of the disaster, whether it's a natural disaster or a man-made disaster. And Naomi Klein in her book researched all of this, and disaster capitalism is a very, very powerful business model, and it's the one that's operative at this stage of our lives. And can I just bring back to mention, of course, historically, the Spanish flu in 1918, that didn't start in Spain. That started at a military base at Kansas, where people would be, you know, young boys were being prepared to go and fight in the First World War. They were given injections to immunize them against flu, and it gave them flu. Now, people can check this. It definitely didn't start in Spain. Spain.
Okay, Martin, I've got some more to say about that, but this does remind me of the last story we did while I was still in the UK, which was about this documentary Cold Case Hammarskjöld, where it was proven that the far-right, basically private army, SIMAR, down in South Africa, was injecting black Africans with so-called vaccines, which actually contained live AIDS virus.
Yeah. In other words, we've got documentary evidence going back quite a long way that these kind of people have engaged in biological warfare. Biological warfare isn't something where you just kill everybody off. What you do is you try and create things which are going to kill specific groups of people, and also things where you can get plausible deniability. And I imagine that the Chinese military probably pretty much know what happened in Wuhan. They don't necessarily say what they know, because you don't want the other side to know that you know what you know. And all of these things will begin to develop.
But, I mean, you may be right about the information warfare, because I noticed on RT, they won't give the figures for the number of cases in Russia or the number of deaths. But what they will do, or in, I'm not sure about Iran, but certainly in Russia, all they're saying is this number of people recovered, whilst they're giving death figures and casualty figures for the rest of the world. For Russia, they won't do that. They'll only give the number of figures recovered.
When we're saying is this serious or not, the Russians closed down their border with China to all people and all cargo. Don't forget, they're trying to build an economic relationship with China. So they obviously took it seriously enough to do that. Now, I would suggest that people who say that it's not as bad as it looks, if you've got, you know, well-informed governments like the Russians and the Chinese saying, no, this is pretty bad, I think you can pretty much guarantee it's as bad as it looks.
Well, I mean, certainly if it's a bioweapon that's leaked out, that's pretty damn serious.
It's a bioweapon, it's designed to cause chaos. And of course, it's the thing that most people haven't realized yet, but it's the most important thing, is this is the biggest bust in capitalism's history. It's already underway. It's definitely going to. Even if the
another two weeks
away, and we're all back to school at Christmas, after Easter rather, and everything. The economic effects have already created a tsunami of follow on effects.
Another story that's been sort of buried by all this, of course, is the fate of Julian Assange. Another one is the SpaceX, which is just being launched, which is 12,000 satellites. The idea is to link up a massive Wi-Fi network all around the planet Earth, and 1 million antennas on the ground. So that's all just been launched, but hardly covered because of all of the coronavirus. But I mean, one of the things I mentioned, the Maoris briefly, they in 1918, you mentioned the Spanish flu there, Martin, from 1918, the records suggest that they were at the time seven times more susceptible than European settlers in New Zealand to the Spanish flu, and seven times more Maoris died of it. So they are very, very worried about this coronavirus and its similarities to the flu. And so they have actually set up checkpoints in Northland and parts of which are predominantly Maori areas. So they're not officially allowed to stop people coming in, but they're saying basically anybody that's not from this part of New Zealand is not welcome. And they've actually got quite a lot of support and quite a lot of evidence that if Maoris are more susceptible to these types of illnesses, that they really don't want any strangers coming into their community at all.
Well, I mean, that's true of a lot of rural communities here. I mean, lots of people have been fleeing to the Scottish Highlands, and of course the locals do not want them there at all. And this is good. You can see all sorts of social norms and ways of doing things are going to be challenged by all of this. And this is the big crisis of the 21st century. We've arrived.
I mean, in a way, Martin, you've sort of been vindicated. You haven't had your crash, but you've had a certain kind of collapse of the economic system, haven't you?
Well, it is. This was going to happen anyway. Definitely, because they had 12 years since 2008 to reform the financial sector, and they didn't do anything.
Well, and as Mervyn King pointed out, we had $166 trillion debt overhang that could never be paid.
Yes, and they just carried on. They carried on just subbing people money to carry on doing what they were doing, and what that was going to crash. Now that's why you've got you talk about means, motive, and opportunity in any criminal enterprise. They've got a motive to do this because it was going to crash anyway. But if it crashes because of COVID-19, then you've got all sorts of policy. You've got a cover story about why it crashed. You've got the people locked down so that they can't protest about whatever measures you want to take, and so on. So that is a plausible scenario for what we're looking at here, because it was going to crash anyway. Before this COVID-19 crisis broke, the stock markets of the world were the highest they'd ever been, but they were wobbling, really wobbling, because they're only basically high on monetary heroin, which is basically, quantitative easing. And isn't it extraordinary that the right-wing governments in both US and Britain have suddenly decided they can nationalise everything with the magic money tree, which they could have always done in the first place, but now they're doing it.
Okay, so we're going to talk about a bit more of speculation in a minute. But, Martin, first of all, we have the anniversary of the horrific Christchurch mosque massacre here in New Zealand. Actually, it was in Christchurch. But there's a Royal Commission looking into it, which is taking place behind closed doors. Not only that, the trial is secret. And also, the gunman has pleaded guilty just today. And therefore, there really will be no scrutiny of anything. And some of the things that I've been digging out, I had a chat to an author who's written a book. He's based down in Tauranga, and he's written a book about the massacre, which includes, he calls it the Christchurch Mosque Massacre, Satanism and John Podesta. And it might sound a bit strange to use Satanism in the title, but the reason he's done that is because of this thing called the Black Sun, which was on the front of his manifesto, which is banned here in New Zealand, which is a satanic symbol, and no one really doubts that. But the interesting thing was that he also includes John Podesta in the title, because John Podesta was here in New Zealand just a couple of days before the massacre took place. Now, can you just give us an idea of who Podesta is, Martin? I know he's very closely associated with the sort of financing and tactics behind the Hillary Clinton's electoral campaign.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know that much about him, but he's definitely an insider in the deep state in the United States of America. And it's very interesting that from what I remember about this shooter, is that he'd been around in Europe. He'd been in places like Bosnia and places like this. And he looks like somebody who's, he comes from that demi-monde. And, obviously I'm always suspicious about these kind of attacks.
What makes me more suspicious is the secrecy under which the so-called investigations are going on, a completely secret Royal Commission and a completely secret trial. 51 people died a year ago, and also three were arrested, suspects. Two were then released. Now, eyewitnesses at the second mosque say that it would be totally impossible for the shooter to get from the first mosque to the second mosque and then be arrested afterwards in another place, that it was simply impossible for him to do it, even if he was just driving from one to the other and not shooting anybody. So it does look as if the two shooters at the second mosque have managed to somehow get away, wriggle out of it, that he couldn't possibly have done all that. But there was also quite incredible the way that the manifesto has been banned here in New Zealand. And also the video, the live streamed video, has also been banned, even apparently to journalists to watch. And I've had a look at it, and I've taken three stills from it. I mean, it's a pretty harrowing thing to watch, obviously. I wouldn't expect anyone to actually want to watch it, but, it's part of my job. And I've taken three stills from that original video, and it's quite clear that there are three people at important waypoints in the attack on the mosque dressed in red. One is where the shooter is parked by the side of the road with his music playing in his car and his left window down. A red figure walks past, and as just after the red figure on the pavement on the left of the car has walked past the open window, we don't actually see them as they're right next to the car, but we see them as they're walking towards it, and we see the windows open. The car then starts moving forward and the attack begins. And the next red figure is at the point where the vehicle turns left into the alleyway with the mosque at the end of it. There's another red figure there that stood in the alleyway. As the car arrives, the red figure turns and then walks back down the road, almost as if to say, it looks as if, honestly, it looks as if the person is saying, right, it's okay to come in here now. And then there's another red figure against the wall of the mosque, which you see on the shooter's webcam just as he's pulling out of the mosque. Now, the guy that's written this book has told me that he's spoken to US Navy SEALs, and he says this is standard operating procedure for a military attack, a military operation. Yep. And also that the use of the strobe light on the video is also a standard military procedure by gunmen, an army operation to kill people. They use the strobe light to disorientate people. So there's not a lot coming out about this attack, Martin, and the main evidence, the guy's manifesto and the video, is totally banned in the country.
Well, I mean, it reminds me a lot of the attack on Utøya in Norway, where a lone gunman apparently killed several people with bombs, got in a car, drove to an island off the coast where there was a Labour Party Young Socialist camp, and manages to kill 60-70 people without being stopped. It just beggars belief. And a lot of these attacks we know are orchestrated from inside the intelligence services. The 9/11.
The other thing, of course, is it also is a bit like the 7/7 attacks in London, Martin. It also makes the terror real. I mean, this is something people have been seeing on TV in New Zealand. We had been seeing it on the TV and reading about it in our newspapers in Britain. But an attack like this turns it into a reality.
Well, what you've got in Norway and New Zealand is a relatively progressive socialist societies, successful socialist societies. They're outside the mainstream. They've got, you know, some of the best, highest standards of living in the world, the most equal communities. And those kind of societies have got to be blooded. You're not allowed to have a successful non-capitalist philosophy in the world today. It's just you're not going to be allowed to do it. The
trial taking place in secret, I find absolutely shocking, because obviously this needs to be, and also now in pleading guilty, there will be virtually no evidence coming out at the trial. This is extremely dodgy. When you also compare it to, there was a mass murder case and a police corruption case which was uncovered, and the guy released from prison here. Then he was accused by a woman or two women of historic sexual abuse, and he's been rearrested. I believe he may be out on bail. I'm not sure of the names of these people. But there's another guy who was the father of someone that died at the Pike River mine accident, which people may remember a few years ago. I think it was in Greymouth or near Greymouth on the South Island. Yeah, sorry to just get obsessed with the New Zealand news for a minute, but it is fascinating to see the way that the justice system has been compromised here. The father of one of the victims in this mine disaster, if people remember, there was a collapse or explosion inside a mine, a coal mine, and the emergency services decided not to go in, were told not to go in, and this was very controversial at the time. And one of the fathers of one of the victims has been very outspoken, and he's now been arrested with historic, again, accusations of sexual misconduct, which is it hardly been reported here, but it's pretty shocking to see that people could potentially be targeted in this way, literally by accusations by, and this is the really incredible bit, is we're not even allowed to know the names or identities or anything of those who've made these accusations that have put people like this in prison.
Yeah, well, New Zealand is one of the Five Eyes countries, so which is the so-called the former echelon network for spying on the world. So, although Norway, of course, is part of NATO. So, although they've got kind of an internal liberal political regime, the external relations of these two small countries are dominated by major powers, the US basically with the Britain. And that's what's going on. We know from a fact, from going back years, that the strategy of tension is the basic modus operandi of Western intelligence services. So you have Muslim extremists killing people, you've got right-wing extremists killing people, you've got just random attacks, and of course things like pandemics and so on, all of which then force the population into a position where they feel that they have to support established authority because they feel threatened, they feel scared, they've got the lack of security. And of course, this is a conscious strategy. It's a war-fighting strategy.
Let's just go back for a minute to last Easter and the horrific attack on the churches or the church in Sri Lanka. I mean, it did transpire, didn't it, I think it was the Saudi Arabians had sent messages to their consulate or embassy in Sri Lanka. Warning of this attack, saying something like this was going to happen, make sure you don't go anywhere near these places. Now, I mean, it was supposed to be a surprise attack, and yet somehow the Saudis knew it was happening.
Yeah, well, it's not a surprise to those who are carrying it out, is it? And that's the truth of the matter. And of course, there are relatives of people who died in the 9/11 attacks who are trying to sue the Saudi Arabian government for complicity in the 9/11 attack. And of course, I think the Saudis were complicit, but I also think the US military were complicit, and so were the Israelis, because their agents were captured at the scene and then went back to Israel and were on TV. The fact is, since we know that they engage in all of this kind of skullduggery, we're bound to ask the question when something like COVID-19 comes along, is this another one of those? And even if it's just something that happened naturally, they immediately batten on to natural disasters in any case, to try and push their agenda. So after Hurricane Katrina wasted all the poor community in the downtown New Orleans, they got rid of all those people, and it's now been redeveloped as luxury housing.
Okay, so look, let's go back to looking at some more speculation, really, to do with the coronavirus, and that is the role of these sort of what get called by various people, John Kulak in the US is one of them. I mean, there's lots of others that talk about the paperclip Nazis, that there is this kind of faction in the United States which was brought over after World War II to fight the Soviet Union. I mean, that these were many war criminals, and there's quite a faction over there, and that there may be some sort of fight going on within the US deep state between a kind of Nazi faction and people who are just simply in the intelligence services and trying to do their job.
Well, I think what you've got, in fact, is there is a faction which is made up of people who were former fascist intelligence operatives. But at the same time, you've got people that have got that sort of mentality in any case in the infrastructure in the West.
Well, it's not these same individual people, because they'd be dead by now, but certainly people with a kind of similar mindset.
So the whole idea of psychological warfare, the idea that by pulling strings behind the scenes, you can get big results, and you can manipulate elections, you can assassinate individuals that you don't like, you can make populations terrified so that they demand measures to be taken to give the state more power. We know for a fact that this has been going on for years. So when something like this comes along, we're inevitably going to ask the question, is this another version of that? And I'm afraid all the evidence tends to suggest it is. And it's not surprising that the Chinese and the Iranian military have already said, we're not happy with your explanation of this. And the Russians have pretty much said the same. We don't believe a word you say. And of course, they've got every reason to say that. It's not as if they just, from sheer bloody mindedness, have decided they're not going to listen to the reasonable prognostications of the likes of Pompeo.
I mean, getting back to the virus.
Posted about lying, stealing.
Getting back to the virus, there is a tension actually between some medical opinion which talks about vaccination as being the right answer, a kind of wonder injection, and others that talk about herd immunity. And medical debate doesn't seem to have been had, and that seems to be like dividing people quite a lot. And do you think it's fair to say that people should be able to choose whether they get vaccinated or not? In the old days, we certainly used to talk about something called informed consent. So doctors, you know, basically just use informed consent on people. People can say if they don't want to be treated or not, and that seems to potentially If they move towards mandatory vaccination, which certainly Germany definitely seems to be doing. In fact, I met a German tourist who was very much pro mandatory vaccination and said to him, well, you know, if you're going to mandatory vaccinate me, then we're going to have to fight about that because I'm not going to be mandatory vaccinated. And he said, oh, that is selfish. Well, no, hang on. So there's a debate potentially, you know, rolling out here between this medical arguments for herd immunity and vaccination.
Well, herd immunity, let's face it, that's just silly. This is a novel virus.
I see which side of the debate you're on, but no, there is definitely some evidence that works. Human populations do develop eventually develop an immunity to these things.
No, listen. The term herd immunity only functions when you've actually got a vaccinated population. When you've got a novel virus, you can't rely on herd immunity. You just can't, because you don't know what it's going to do. Yeah. So that's why the British line of we're going to develop herd immunity collapsed in about a week. And then they had to, because nobody else is approaching it like that. So that's just off the table. Now, vaccines, if you're going to vaccinate people, you've got to show that this vaccine has been developed without any private profit being made from it, for example. So that
isn't it, in the modern world?
It's impossible under our system. It's not impossible in other parts of the world where the healthcare system, like in Cuba, is not based on making any private profits for anybody. And in actual fact, that's what makes their system superior. So we've got all of these questions about how you actually deal with genuine threats, if there is a genuine threat. And then beyond that, you've got the actual fact that we may be dealing with what is a bio-psycho-warfare attack. So it's basically an attack on people's minds so you can achieve certain political objectives. Now, I'm certainly not convinced either way yet. We've got to keep an open mind about it. But the idea that this is some kind of come on by the bad people is absolutely logical and rational. And anybody who says otherwise doesn't know what they're talking about.
What do you think about the we've seen in China now it's become a criminal offence to eat wild meat? That is to say, you know, if you find, say, for example, a roadkill pheasant, if they exist, I suppose they do in China actually, and you take it home and you eat it, you will be, if you're anyone from the authorities finds out, as they tend to do in China, you'll go to jail potentially for eating wild meat. Now, this is also a way, of course, of forcing people to go. I mean, there's actually quite a lot of people here in New Zealand who eat quite a lot of their food, either get fish or go hunting to get their food. Pig hunting's a big thing here in Coromandel. So that does seem to be a very draconian measure, it seems to me. And they think that the wild food is a way of spreading this virus. But it's also, of course, a way of surviving in a financial collapse.
Well, it is. But you know, you've got people doing eating bushmeat in Africa. But it's devastating for the wildlife, and they do it because they haven't got any access to any sort of protein. The real economic effects of this are going to, well, let's, for example, just do a little thought experiment. What if the Chinese capitalist economy collapses here? Because capitalist economies do, yeah? They've got a massive property bubble in Shanghai and all the rest of it, same as in...
But banks can always make up more money, Martin.
Well, that's what they've, and they've got state-owned banks in China, so they can intervene more aggressively than in the West. But nevertheless, the problem about any capitalist system is it's based on boom and bust is real. And when bust comes, what are you going to do? Some people are going to eat bats. Some people are going to take a gun and shoot the people who are eating bats. Then the people who are eating bats might take guns and shoot them back, or they might organize themselves into militias of one kind or another. This is going to be a test of the social and political structures of the whole of human society. It's just horrendous. And the consequences are going to be pretty bad, whichever way it plays out. I can't see good consequences from this coming anytime soon.
What we've seen in Israel, of course, is a corruption charge against the prime minister, who's now leading the charge against coronavirus. So he's the guy, Netanyahu, who's in charge of dealing with coronavirus, but he was being tried for corruption. Also, of course, in France, Macron was facing possibly the end of his presidency through mass protests. Now, the boot is on the other foot. The yellow vests have been told if you come out on the street, you are going to be arrested.
Well, yes, and that's bound to create suspicion, isn't it? Now, let's presume, for the sake of argument, this is a natural event, that there isn't actually any more sinister aspect to it. But even if it is just a natural event, you can see the temptation for political leaders to use this event, this series of events, to achieve various objectives that they had already in their minds. That's basically the thesis of Naomi Klein's book, Disaster Capitalism. She doesn't say that they deliberately create the disasters, but they, as soon as a disaster happens, they batten on it like vultures, you know, vultures eating.
They haven't really been talking about police state or state of emergency. What we've heard here in New Zealand is that the government doesn't want to use these terms because they might cause panic, but actually that is what's in place.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm in two minds as reasonable people should be about this, because in many ways, the unselfish behaviour of Cuban doctors as they go in to try and deal with pandemics and epidemics in the developing world is absolutely exemplary. But that implies that you've got to have some kind of, you know, controlling public officials in charge of it all. The West isn't run like that. I mean, basically, the West is, I mean, did you see the people that Trump had with him on his press conferences? It's not mostly medical people. It's the heads of big corporations. Amazon and Google and all these other people are there with him saying that we're going to fight this virus together. But they're basically private organizations with a private agenda.
Well, maybe one of the purposes of this legislation, and the particular the lockdown as a reaction to the virus, is to squash all of their competition.
Well, yes, and of course, if you know what you're doing, you can benefit from any from a disaster. You just have to be in the right place at the right time. And there was going to be a crash anyway. The COVID-19 aspect of the crash means that it's been very, very severe and very quick. But it was going to happen anyway, and it provides a perfect cover for governments to then... I mean, basically, Wall Street has just been given another paycheck from the taxpayers in the US, and then nobody's paying any attention because everybody's worried about...
Well, but it'll be interesting to see if any of that filters down to ordinary people. Look, okay, so the question is, I suppose, now that we're not allowed to meet except, I suppose, on some sort of internet chat place, is dissent possible? Is it a good idea for dissenters, for political meetings to take place, for the potentially government measures to be questioned, criticised by the population?
Well, I think a key thing for me is we need to get testing doing so that we've got some idea of how many people have actually got the virus and whether it actually leads automatically to bad. You know, some people might get the virus and have no symptoms. Again, that could be an aspect of it as a biowarfare weapon. But why aren't we testing? In South Korea, they've been testing, to try and work out who the hell's got it. Because if you can work out who's got it, then the people who haven't got it can get on with their business.
Well, I mean, maybe the impetus on the government not to test is because they might find...
Rather less. You see what I mean? Either way.
Rather less, yes.
It could be,
also,
could be...
Martin, finally, what's your... would you like to speculate on how long these extreme measures will be in place? We're told here 4 weeks. You've got 3 weeks, but it may be longer.
The hope is that if we really go for it straight away with a big... lockdown.
But when you say go for it, that means they're trying to flatten the curve. That's the point, isn't it?
They don't want the hospitals to be overrun. I mean, the London hospitals are basically saying today we're being overwhelmed. Yeah. So that's what you don't want. And of course, that then leads a knock on effect of all these other people who actually need healthcare can't get to a hospital or a doctor because they're overwhelmed with the coronavirus. So they start dying. Then, of course, people start losing their jobs and get put, then they get kicked out of their houses. Because they can't pay the rent. How can you self-isolate if you're just being evicted? That's the danger. And of course, all of these things then come to a head in the United States where everybody's got automatic weapons.
That's one thing we've seen here in New Zealand is a big increase in queues at the gun shops before they were closed. I suppose what we're seeing really is a division of people from healthy scepticism, obviously obeying the sensible rules to stop spreading any kind of contamination, and those who are militantly obedient. What we've seen certainly here is a sort of rise in the little Hitlers, people who are shouting at you. And Jacinda, the Prime Minister here, has said, look, be kind. You know, there's no need to be a little Hitler. She hasn't said that. That's me.
Well, I think what you're finding here in Bristol, I've been going out every day, is there's definitely a sort of wary camaraderie developing. You know, people that wouldn't normally talk to you are talking to you. Yeah. But at the same time, people are clearly fearful. And, you know, you're seeing some of the best in people's human behavior. And also you're seeing people behaving rather badly as they just try and look after number one and don't think of anybody else. But I mean, that's what you'd expect to find.
What it's done for me anyway is it's shown me the value of face-to-face contact. And that's the one thing we're being told in some ways, certainly by, people on the radio, you're not allowed to go out. Well, that's just simply not the case.
Yeah, well, I think we are going out here in Bristol, but people are keeping a fairly safe.
I mean, obviously, it makes sense for elderly people not to, potentially, but, yeah. you are allowed to go out. And I think the face-to-face stuff seems to me to be, in a way, a bit like what happened in the Arab Spring in Egypt, in Cairo, when they switched the internet off, everybody went out and started organising protests and stuff.
You can see that because of the nature of this situation, that's not going to be so straightforward, is it? And
no.
that raises questions, doesn't it? But I mean, we shall see what's the effects of this are going to carry on for decades. Yeah, whatever happens now, this is the big inflection point, and we're going to be living with the consequences of this for the rest of our lives, all of us.
Time to sign off now for the USA and Comcast News at 11 for the BCFM broadcast of this podcast and on Monday evening. Thanks to our guests, David Halpin and Nigel Day from Oxford CND. Also to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and studio engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM week. I'll be back in the UK in April, God willing. Do please join us on the BCFM emergency schedule dialect politics show online on Friday or on FM at 10 p.m. Monday. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
The groovy. and dirty, baby. Down and dirty, baby.